Chapter 14. Leaving Villa d'Este. Along with my win over Potanin, everything else seemed to be going my way in Russia. In 1997, the Hermitage Fund was ranked the best-performing fund in the world, up 235% and 718% from inception. Our assets under management had grown from the original $25 million to more than $1 billion. The New York Times, Business Week, the Financial Times, and Time Magazine all profiled me as a wunderkind of modern-day finance. My clients competed with each other to invite me to their yachts in the south of France, and I was being wined and dined in every city in which I set foot. All of this was hugely exhilarating, and it was happening to me, a 33-year-old who had started his business only 2 years earlier. In hindsight, I should probably have been a little more circumspect. Any one of these developments was cause to celebrate, but taken collectively, they constituted, in the parlance of Wall Street, one big sell signal. I understood this intellectually, but viscerally I just wanted my blessed life to carry on forever. Therefore, I stayed fully invested, thinking that everything would continue the way that it had. Others did not share my optimism, principally Edmund Safra. He gave me a call in early April 1998 and said, "Bill, I'm concerned about all the stuff going on with Asia. Shouldn't we be liquidating our positions?" He was referring to the Asian economic crisis that had started in the summer of 1997, in which Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, and South Korea suffered major currency devaluations, bond defaults, and severe recessions. "I think we should hold tight and wait until this storm passes, Edmund. Russia will be okay."
"How can you say that, Bill? We've taken a huge hit already."
He was justified in his concern. In January 1998, the fund lost 25% of its value. But by April, it had recovered about half of its losses, and I was convinced that things were on the way back up. "The market is bouncing now. When things calm down, we'll make everything back."
"Tell me why you think that's the case," he said, sounding unconvinced.
"Because the fear that Russia is on the brink is just that, fear. It's based on sentiment, not fundamentals."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, first, Russia doesn't do much trade with Asia. Second, Russia doesn't compete with Asia. And third, the Asians don't invest in Russia. I just don't see how the Asian problems will jump over here."
Edmund took a second or two before he said, "I really hope you're right, Bill."
I hoped I was right, too. Unfortunately, I was dead wrong. What I'd completely missed was that the world is one big sea of liquidity. If the tide goes out one place, then it goes out everywhere. When big investors started to lose money in Asia, they began unloading risky securities from their portfolios everywhere else in the world, and anything Russian was at the top of that list. This created a pernicious situation for the Russian government. Over the previous few years, Russia, running a huge budget deficit to pay for public services, had borrowed $40 billion by issuing 3-month ruble treasury bills. This meant, just to keep its head above water, every 3 months, the government had to sell $40 billion of new bonds to pay back the $40 billion of previous ones that were due. On top of that, Russia had to pay interest rates in excess of 30% to attract buyers, so the debt bills kept getting bigger and bigger. This wouldn't be a prudent financing strategy in the best of times, but it became downright suicidal in the worst of times. The only thing that could now save Russia was the International Monetary Fund, IMF. As spring arrived in Moscow, IMF intervention was all that brokers and their clients talked about. Interestingly, the Russian government didn't share our obsession. I wasn't sure whether it was arrogance or stupidity, but the Kremlin was playing hardball with the IMF when it should have been on its knees, begging. In mid-May, Larry Summers, then the U.S. Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, traveled to Russia to decide how the United States should deal with what appeared to be an impending meltdown. Since the United States was the biggest member of the IMF, Summers' view would effectively determine the outcome. Although every Western politician understood that he was one of the world's most influential financial power players, when the Russian Prime Minister, Sergei Kiryenko, saw that Summers was merely a deputy secretary, he was insulted and refused to take the meeting. A few days later, on May 23, 1998, the IMF mission that had traveled to Russia to negotiate a $20 billion bailout package ran into similar obstinacy and gave up on its talks. Both Summers and the IMF left the country without an agreement on the table. With no IMF money to prop up the Russian bond market, the Russian government had to raise the interest rate it paid on its domestic bonds from 30% to 44% to entice buyers. However, instead of attracting investors, this had the opposite effect. Wall Street smelled blood. If Russia needs to raise rates from 30 to 44%, the thinking went, then there must be something seriously wrong, and I don't want anything to do with it. This lack of confidence caused the Russian stock market to crash, and my fund fell a jaw-dropping 33% in May, leaving us down 50% for the year. Edmund had been right. Losing so much money threw me into a quandary. Should we sell when we're already down 50%? Or should we stand firm and wait for a recovery? The thought of locking in a 50% loss forever was mortifying. I thought the market had bottomed, so I recommended holding our positions and waiting for an IMF bailout. In early June, rumors started to circulate that the IMF was back at the negotiating table. The markets jumped, and the fund went up 9% in a single week. But then the following week, the rumors turned negative, and the fund dropped by 8%. By July, interest rates on Russian bonds had reached a staggering 120%. Russia would certainly default if the IMF didn't step in. People such as Larry Summers and the technocrats at the IMF may have been furious at the Russian government for being so arrogant, but they knew a disorderly sovereign default in Russia would be catastrophic. And at the last minute, the United States threw its weight behind a huge bailout package. On July 20th, the IMF and World Bank stepped in with $22.6 billion, immediately releasing the first tranche of $4.8 billion. When I saw the headlines, I felt an overpowering sense of relief. My nerves had been completely fried by the drumbeat of bad news, but now a backstop was in place. It looked as if this bailout would save Russia, as well as my investors' money. The following week, the fund recovered 22% of its losses. The phone started ringing as I took calls from relieved clients and brokers, and we started to discuss how the recovery might play out. But I was too quick to declare victory. The bailout package may have been big, but it was viewed by the Russian oligarchs not as a backstop, but as a massive piggy bank that they could use to convert their rubles into dollars in order to get that money as far away from Russia as possible. Over the next 4 weeks, $6.5 billion worth of rubles were converted to dollars by Russian oligarchs. Just like that, the country was right back where it had started before the IMF stepped in. As if these financial gyrations weren't enough, my marriage was also slowly deteriorating. Ever since the Sedanko incident, Sabrina had grown more and more angry with me. She saw my decision to fight Patanin as a betrayal, and she wanted me to move back to London. I reminded her that in spite of all the scary stuff, moving to Moscow was what she had agreed to, but she didn't see it that way. She was also completely unsympathetic to my arguments about my duty to my investors. We were having a difficult time finding any meaningful way to connect. Aside from taking care of David, which she did beautifully, the only part of our marriage that she was engaged with was planning our family holidays. These were the only times that Sabrina and I spent more than a weekend in each other's company. So I gave her full rein to organize whatever she wanted, in the hope that these trips would draw us closer together. Earlier in the summer, before everything was falling apart in the Russian financial markets, Sabrina had booked a suite at the Villa d'Este Hotel on Lake Como in Italy. A suite at this five-star hotel cost $1,200 per night, which was more money than I'd spent on my entire post-college summer vacation. I was always uncomfortable with these extravagant holidays, whether I could afford them or not. My mother, who had fled the Holocaust, had instilled in me the idea that spending money on luxuries was stupid and irresponsible. Given my circumstances, this was irrational, but I still found it hard to pay $30 for a continental breakfast. I would often feign an excuse to skip breakfast and ask Sabrina to bring back a few rolls because I felt so guilty about wasting money. This specific holiday could not have come at a worse time. The markets were moving up and down 5% a day, and I shouldn't have been more than 5 feet from my desk. But if I'd canceled, it would have thrown my marriage into complete crisis. So in mid-August, I flew to Milan, got in a car, and met Sabrina and David at Lake Como. The contrast between Lake Como and Moscow was staggering. Where everyone was aggressive, angry, and tense in Russia, everyone was tanned, relaxed, and happy in Italy. We checked into our lavish two-bedroom suite, and after getting settled, I went to sit on the terrace. I saw the crystal-clear alpine lake and the rolling foothills of the Alps, and watched as people splashed and laughed in the water. The air was still and warm and smelled of pine trees. None of it seemed real. I tried to clear my head and not obsess about every twist and turn in the market over the following few days, but it was impossible. The only peaceful moments came at the crack of dawn, when David woke up. I would dress him and fill his bottle with milk, and we would share a couple of quiet hours, walking around the hotel's manicured grounds while Sabrina slept. I really enjoyed these intimate moments. But then on August 18th, after our morning walk, when David and I were both on the balcony overlooking the lake while Sabrina was taking a bath, Vadim called in a state of panic from Moscow. "Bill, it all seems to be happening." "What's happening?" I asked, not understanding the context.
"The ruble is in a free fall. The government is no longer supporting the currency. Analysts are saying it'll level out at 75% down."
Oh my God. I put my water bottle on the metal table. I was utterly shocked. A dark bird whisked past, banking hard toward the water. David made a small, happy sound.
"It gets worse, Bill. They also announced they're defaulting on domestic debt."
"What? Why would they default when they can just print money to pay it back? That doesn't make any sense."
"Bill, nothing these guys do makes any sense," Vadim said in a resigned tone.
"How are the markets taking it?" I asked, preparing for the worst.
"It's a complete meltdown. The bids have evaporated. A few sporadic trades are going through anywhere from 80 to 95% down.
I ended the call without saying anything else, picked up David, and walked inside. Not in my worst nightmares had I seen this coming. Before my conversation with Vadim, I thought the market had hit bottom. I knew in that instant that I had to get back to Moscow. When I told Sabrina, she asked why I couldn't just take care of it from the hotel. I tried to explain the gravity of what was going on, and that it was imperative that I be in Moscow. But she just couldn't understand. I packed hastily, and when I was ready to leave, I tried to hug Sabrina, but she rebuffed me. I picked David up and gave him a tight squeeze. I got back to Moscow that night, and when the dust finally settled, the fund was nursing a $900 million loss, a 90% drop. That was bottom. It's hard to describe what it's like to lose $900 million. I could feel it on the sides of my stomach, as if I had been emptied out from the inside. For weeks afterward, my shoulder blades tingled unpleasantly, as if I literally carried the loss on my back. And it wasn't just a financial loss. I had spent the previous 2 years extolling the virtues of investing in Russia, and now I had let all of my investors down in spectacular fashion. It was also a public humiliation. The same journalists who'd clamored to showcase me on the way up were now desperate to go into all the gory details of my downfall. It was as if I were the victim of a horrible car accident, and every passerby was slowing down to see the carnage and the burning wreck of metal. Yet in my mind, I had only one choice: to stay. I had to make back all the money I had lost for my clients. I wasn't going to leave Russia with my tail between my legs. That was simply not how I wanted to be remembered.